All right, so this is Bio 160, February 13th, and we're finishing up the chapter, metabolism, chapter 4, and then we're going to start chapter 5, and you got some handouts for chapter 5. If you are missing handouts for chapter 4, you'll just come by my office after class, and I'll give them to you. All right, so I think we were talking about DNA last time. The building blocks of DNA and what it looks like, but let's just kind of review everything. DNA has, especially when we compare it to, what's the cousin molecule to DNA?
RNA.
Yeah, RNA. I don't know if that's proper terminology or sister, brother, whatever. All right, it's related to DNA. That would be RNA. So DNA is always double-stranded. You see two strands? RNA is single-stranded, so I'm going to mention that a number of times. The bases that you have in DNA are guanine, cytosine, adenine, and thymine. And this slide also shows what the base pairing rules are for DNA. When you see a G, what's on the other side? Cytosine, right? Yeah. So guanine and cytosine always pair up. And then adenine always pairs up with thymine. So no matter which is on which side, those are the only two that fit together inside this ladder or the double helix right here. That's the only way that they can, that this molecule can form. All right, so besides being double-stranded, how do you know this is DNA and not RNA? Yeah, because DNA has thymine. If this were RNA, you wouldn't see any thymines anyplace. You would just see uracil. So every place that you'd see a T, you'd have to swap that out with a uracil. But remember, RNA just would have one strand, not a double strand. So that's another way to think about it. All right. A process, a real important process, is what do we call when we make more DNA from DNA? What do we call that process? Okay, you should, might be thinking of three different things, and then you got to choose the right one. You could be thinking of transcription, translation, and then the third one, replication. And as a matter of fact, when we make more DNA from DNA, we call that replication. Replication. So it's not transcription, not translation. And how do we go about doing that? We modify that word replication. Well, first, we have to separate the strands. And these little dots right here represent hydrogen bonds. And can anybody remember how strong is a hydrogen bond? Is it a weak bond or is it a strong bond? It's a weak bond. So it's relatively easy to unzip this molecule. Right? And there is an unzipperase enzyme that actually unzips this molecule and separates them. This is at the beginning of replication. So let's break the molecule apart. We can unzip it. So here is the original DNA molecule. We unzip it right here. So here we have a thymine. And over here, on the other strand, we have an adenine. Of course, is that a proper base pair? Adenine on one side, thymine on the other? Yeah, it sure is. Okay. So if we're going to add nucleotides, which is the building block for nucleic acids like DNA right here, if we're going to add a nucleotide, what nucleotide would we add to this adenine right here? That'd be thymine. Ah, you're right. Okay? And if we have this thymine right here, what nucleotide are we going to add right here? Adenine. Okay? So, when we replicate, we unzip, but you know what? We never cut. We never cut the sequence of nucleotides. The only thing we do is separate the two strands, and then we use the old strand as a template on how to add nucleotides in the right position. So let's look at this one right here. Adenine. What does adenine base pair with? Thymine, which you could see. So here's going to be a new nucleotide added to this strand over here. All right, so if this is a thymine, what would you guess would be the nucleotide on the complementary strand on the other side that you started with? What should it be? Okay, well it should be thymine. And is it thymine? Oh, there it is right there. Okay? So when we use the old strand as a template for making the new strand, we end up with what? Two identical pieces of DNA, and that's what we want, because the sequence of nucleotides in a DNA molecule is information. If we change the sequence of nucleotides in DNA, then we change how your cell is going to function. We'll change how proteins are made. We call that a mutation, and most of those changes would be very harmful. So this is a way we can make more copies of DNA without changing the sequence. When I say sequence, what do I mean? If we go down this strand over here, the correct sequence would be what? T-G-A-C-A-C-T. That never changes when we make more DNA. That sequence is the same before and afterwards. And how is that accomplished? Say you want to make a shirt or something, and you want to make 20 copies of the exact same shirt because it fits you just right. What would you use? Yeah, you would use a template. You would replicate it, right? You'd use a template, and you can go out and buy templates, and then you would cut your fabric exactly along that template so that you would have all those shirts exactly the same. But if you just had an idea in your mind about how to cut it, what would you end up with? 20 different size shirts. And they all might be kind of similar, but not really exact. But if you use a template, it's always exactly the same thing. So the cool thing about DNA replication is that one old strand acts as a template for one new strand, and the other old strand acts like a template for what? The other new strand. And so DNA can be replicated over and over and over and over again without changing anything, which is the beauty of that process. Okay, because if this DNA changes, what happens to you? Well, then you change. And chances are it's not going to be in a very good way. It might be a cancerous change, right? Or maybe it will change the way that your red blood cells carry oxygen or something. That would be fatal. Okay, so this kind of replication where the new molecule, see, here's the new molecule. You got what? Two new molecules of DNA. And if you look at a new molecule, is it single-stranded or double-stranded? It's double, right? Because it's DNA. And what can you tell me about the strands? You've got one old one and one new one. And the other one, you got one old one and one new one. All right? And because you got one old and one new in a new molecule, we call that semi-conservative. Semi-conservative replication. So most times when we say replication, we don't just say replication, but we know it is semi-conservative. I'm running out of board. Semi-conservative, which means what? The new molecule has one old strand and one new strand. Okay. So that's something interesting about DNA. Anybody have a question about that? The strandedness and the way things are replicated.
I think I want a
little blocker piece of paper right here. All right, so there we go. DNA replication, semi-conservative. So anytime you see DNA going to DNA, and I put that on the first test by accident, so everybody got an extra credit point for that because I didn't tell you what DNA going to making more DNA is called. But now you would say replication. And if your choice is semi-conservative, then maybe I would choose that. So should I put that on the next test? No? Oh, it's easy. Okay, sure. If it's not, remind me and I'll put it on the board as an extra credit. Okay. Protein synthesis. I think I've talked about this before, but it's so important I just want to go over one more time. Okay. Information, the way that information flows, it goes from one molecule to another, and we call this the central dogma in biology. A dogma is just something you're told that you should never question. Right? But is that realistic? No, you should always question authority, right? Because you're not always, because not everybody is correct 100% of the time. But then, so we call this the central dogma. This is just something that you should take for granted. And that is that the information of how to build your body and how your body functions, that information is controlled in DNA. Uh-oh, I got to sneeze. Thank you. All of that information is contained in DNA. Where do you have DNA? In the nucleus, yeah, and that nucleus protects the DNA from becoming corrupted. All right? And so that information cannot leave the DNA, but that information has to go into the cytoplasm to help control the cell. And in order to do that, that information's got to be copied into something. All right? So the copying of the information in DNA to RNA, do you remember me talking about this? Okay. We call that transcription. It's like making a photocopy. Why do we call that transcription? Think of the building blocks. What are the building blocks of DNA? Nucleotides. And what's the building block of RNA? Nucleotides. So it's the same language, right? It's just making a photocopy or a transcript, so we call that transcription. This RNA then can leave the nucleus because it's only single-stranded. It's a little bit smaller. Then the information in RNA is used to make a protein or a polypeptide. And we call that translation. And why do we call that step translation? Because what are the building blocks of a polypeptide? Amino acid. What are the building blocks of RNA? Nucleotide. Are they different? Yes. So when you go from one language to another language, we call that translation. All right, so that step is translation. All right, so transcription happens where? Transcription happens in nucleus, because the DNA can never leave the nucleus. It's protected there. But what about translation? That's the cytosol. So it happens in two little bit different locations. All right, so now you know these three processes, replication, transcription, translation, about where they take place inside the cell. Okay. Now, what do I want to say about protein synthesis? Oh, the central dogma also says that the information flows in this one-way direction. It can't flow from a protein. The information, or the way that amino acids get put together in a protein, can't be put back into your DNA. That information can't go backwards. It's just a one-way street. So information goes DNA, RNA, protein, not protein, RNA, DNA. And I think I mentioned before, that's a really good thing. I kind of said it in kind of a funny way. But why is that a really good thing? Because tonight when you go home and have a chicken dinner and you eat a bunch of chicken protein, that protein, right, can't change you overnight and turn you into a chicken. Right? So that's why we like this to be just a one-way street, and indeed it is. Okay? Okay. So that's real important. I'm not going to go over all this kind of stuff that I have right here. As a matter of fact, I might not cover any of this stuff right here. But I do want to say, something about transcription. Transcription is what? DNA making RNA that happens inside the nucleus. RNA, this is important. RNA is single-stranded. It's not double-stranded. You should know something about the base pairing rules, right? Adenine pairs with uracil instead of thymine. Okay, guanine still pairs with cytosine. Okay. All right, then, one of the study questions says, what are the three kinds of RNA? You should at least have a little bit of knowledge that there are different kinds of RNA. And here's where they are. The first one, you got messenger RNA. Messenger RNA is the thing that's most like the DNA. That's what you use to add amino acids to, and remember, amino acid is a building block of a protein. It adds amino acids to a growing protein when it's made. So you could think of an amino acid as a link in a chain, or maybe bricks in a line. The messenger RNA determines the sequence of amino acids in a protein. You got another thing called rRNA. That stands for ribosomal RNA. Have you heard of a ribosome before? Yeah. What is it? Yeah, but on the diagram that I had before. Yeah, it's like a little dot, right? It's like a little dot that you see inside the cell. And what could you tell me about that little dot? We always said that's where proteins are made, right? So a ribosome is, we can consider that the workbench. That's where the protein is actually made. So that workbench needs instructions in the messenger RNA to make a protein, but it's something that attaches to the messenger RNA to help make a protein. So we talked about messenger RNA and ribosomal RNA. Messenger is the instructions. Our RNA is where the instructions can be used. But before you can make a protein, what has to come to the workbench before you can make a protein? You need the amino acids. So that tells us something about the last kind of RNA, and that's called the tRNA. The transfer RNA. Sometimes I call that the taxi RNA. The taxi RNA goes around in the cytoplasm, grabs onto an amino acid, and brings it to the ribosome so that it can be put into a protein as the protein is getting bigger and bigger. So those are the things that I would like for you to know on these pieces of paper. What? The tRNA, taxi RNA? All right. Well, first let's make sure I highlight a couple things. The three types of RNA: messenger, ribosomal, and transfer RNA. The transfer RNA carries amino acids to the ribosome. So a ribosome can't make a protein unless it has amino acids. And it's the transfer RNA that goes around in the cytoplasm, grabs an amino acid, and brings it to the ribosome so it can be made into a protein. Okay, once it gives up its amino acid to make a, if that amino acid gets put into a protein, it loses the amino acid. It comes off of the ribosome, and now it doesn't have one. It's going to go around through the cytoplasm and find its amino acid again. So then it can bring another amino acid. So it's just going to cycle back and forth, back and forth. It gives away the amino acid, and then it goes and it finds another one, and it brings another amino acid to a ribosome. It has a finite life depending on how much the cell needs of that particular protein. Okay? So it will recycle. And the ribosome can recycle itself. After a protein is made, it can make some more. And the messenger RNA can recycle itself and can make more protein. All right, so that's what I want you to know about replication. Is what, DNA to DNA? It's semi-conservative. You should know something about the building blocks of DNA. Let's see, what else? The central dogma. DNA to RNA is transcription. That happens in the nucleus. RNA to protein is translation. That happens in the cytoplasm. And when DNA is transcribed, what do you get out of that? When DNA is transcribed, what molecule do you get? Yeah, you get RNA. And how many kinds of RNA do you have? Yeah, what are the three kinds? mRNA, rRNA, and tRNA. And you need all of those three to make a protein. And that RNA, because it's small, single-stranded, it can leave the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm where it can make a protein. Okay, so that's the level that I want you to understand protein synthesis. Your book has some pretty nice pictures, but I don't think we're going to go into that kind of detail. But if you want to read some of this stuff and follow the pictures in your book, that's fine. But I think we're done with this chapter, except for the review questions. Okay, has anybody listened to the recordings in the library to go over the explanations of these review questions? It could be helpful for a test. Okay, if you're wondering what you could do for a test to help study, that could be one thing. All right, and everything is on CD in the reserve section, and you can download it to a little cheapo recorder, or you could put it on a flash drive and take it home, put it in your computer, or whatever. But listening to a lecture won't help everybody. Some people are visual learners. They need to look at a picture. By listening to somebody talk, it will just put you to sleep. All right? Some people need to read. They need to read the book. If you give me a book to read, that will put me to sleep. All right? I like to listen to somebody. So we all learn a little bit differently. But if you're the kind of person that can learn while listening to somebody, okay, then it's real helpful. But if you need to see a picture or read, then it won't help you so much. All right, but nonetheless, let's go over this. What is the purpose of cellular respiration? What? Yeah, it takes glucose, turns it into carbon dioxide, that's for sure it does, but what's the primary purpose? It's producing ATP, right? So we're changing the energy in glucose into little bits of energy, which we call ATP. And everything in your cell can use ATP. Right, so ATP is the molecule that's used. What's the difference between anabolism and catabolism? Okay, so let's start with one. Sometimes I ask a really complicated question. And so the first question is, what is anabolism? So anabolism is when we take a bunch of building blocks and make something big out of it. Anabolism. For instance, we take amino acids and make a protein. We take monosaccharides and make a polysaccharide. We take nucleotides and make a nucleic acid, like DNA, okay, or RNA. What else? We could take fatty acids and glycerol and make a fat, like a triglyceride, okay? That would be anabolism. Now, what about catabolism? Yep. It's the opposite. You take a protein and make what out of it? Amino acids. You take glycogen, which is a polysaccharide, and you make what out of it? Monosaccharides. Or you take a triglyceride and you make fatty acids and glycerol out of it. Fatty acids and glycerol. So it's the opposite thing. All right. Now here it gets interesting. What are the two kinds of respiration? Aerobic and anaerobic. But you know what? You probably got to know something about them. Where does anaerobic respiration take place? The cytosol. That's right. And where does aerobic respiration take place? That's in the mitochondria. Okay. So what are the products of aerobic and anaerobic respiration? But let's start with the first one, aerobic. What is produced with aerobic respiration? Immediately, when you think of respiration, you should think of ATP, right? And I think that's what you were saying. How much ATP with aerobic respiration? A lot. Yeah, 36, 38, something like that. 30-something, way up there in the 30s. All right, and what about anaerobic respiration? Measly 2, okay? But if that's all you can get, you got to take it. All right, so aerobic is much more efficient than anaerobic. What other molecule does aerobic respiration require compared to anaerobic? It requires oxygen. That's in the name, aerobic respiration. Anaerobic respiration doesn't require oxygen. That's why, we only get 2 ATP for every glucose molecule. Where does aerobic respiration take place? Aerobic is in the mitochondria. Mitochondria need that oxygen. And anaerobic respiration just takes place in the cytosol. Okay. Where do the carbon atoms in CO2 come from when we exhale it, when we breathe? Where does that carbon dioxide? Carbon dioxide is a gas, but we don't eat by inhaling gas, right? When we eat something for nourishment, what's a good energy molecule? Glucose. So the carbon atoms in glucose actually go into that carbon dioxide. And we breathe, so we eat glucose, that's a solid food, and we what? We excrete the waste products by what? Just exhaling carbon dioxide right out of our body. So they come from glucose. That CO2 actually comes from a glucose molecule. So we use the chemical energy in glucose, convert it into the chemical energy in ATP. What's the last molecule produced by anaerobic metabolism? Anaerobic. It makes some ATP, but anaerobic metabolism, have you ever worked out real hard lifting weights or something, and how did that feel after a while? It hurt. Because that muscle's operating kind of anaerobically when it's contracted, it produces what? Lactate, lactic acid. So that acid makes your muscle hurt. So anaerobic respiration, the last product that's formed is lactate. Don't forget about those two ATP though, but lactate. What about aerobic respiration? This is a little funny, but the picture in your book is really good. It shows what's going on. You know what? The last thing that's formed is actually water. Okay, so aerobic respiration uses oxygen up, and that oxygen ends up in water right here. So water is the last thing. But as water is being produced, is that the important molecule that's being produced? Water is real important for you, of course. But what's even more important? ATP. Right? So ATP is being produced aerobically.
So that's
for number six?
Yeah.
Number six. The last molecule produced by anaerobic respiration is lactic acid. And then the last part of the question is, what last molecule is produced by aerobic respiration? It's H2O. It's actually water. And what's kind of funny about that? I think I mentioned this a number of times. What's funny about that? Water is not only the solvent that our body is dissolved in and functions. Water does what? It participates in many of the important chemical reactions, almost all the chemical reactions, like hydrolysis or dehydration synthesis reactions, as well as what? Aerobic respiration. So water is real important. I don't know how else to say that. I'll have to think of another way of saying that. I don't know. Okay, I'll think of an analogy one of these days. Okay, what is the structure of DNA? Okay, different ways you could think about it. Think about it in terms of building blocks. What are the building blocks? Nucleotides, namely what? Adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine. DNA is single-stranded or double-stranded? It's double-stranded. And I suppose maybe if you want to know the building blocks of a nucleotide, that's fine. It has a what? For DNA, it's a deoxyribose sugar, a base, and a phosphate. But that really describes the structure of a nucleotide, not necessarily DNA itself. But DNA is double-stranded, and the bases, and then you should know the base pairing rules. ATGC. What sugar is found in DNA? Okay, it's in the word. DNA is what? Deoxyribose. And what bases are found in DNA? Well, these a little redundant. Adenine, thymine, cytosine, guanine. ATGC, usually we say. We don't usually pronounce those words out completely every single time. And what are the base pairing rules? ATGC. For some reason, that sticks in my mind. I don't know why. Hopefully it just sticks in your mind that easy too. Okay. Well, what's your question? What's the question? What? No, read me the question. I'll give you the answer. I'm not sure I know your question. Base pairing rules for DNA are AT and GC. Adenine pairs with thymine. Guanine pairs with cytosine. Okay. How is DNA replication accomplished? How's it accomplished? You could describe it, but if you just use the correct terminology, I would know what you're talking about. What terminology would you use? You would say semi-conservative replication, and then I would know. One old strand, one new strand. So knowing nomenclature really helps sometimes. Where does it take place? In the nucleus. Yeah, you don't want that DNA running around in the cell, in the cytoplasm or cytosol anywhere, because it can get damaged. So it's in the nucleus where that happens. What's the structure of RNA? Single-stranded. I like that. What sugar is found in RNA? Is it different than DNA? A little bit. Yeah, it's ribose instead of deoxyribose. And what bases are found in RNA? Yeah, A, U, C, G. And then this probably is, what are the base pairing rules? It's A, U, and G, C are the base pair rules. Similar to DNA, but not exactly. What are the three kinds of RNA? mRNA, rRNA, and tRNA. And what does rRNA make? It makes a ribosome. rRNA makes the ribosome, that little dot you see inside the cell. And the messenger RNA is what? That gives you the information to make a protein, the sequence of amino acids, or the sequence in nucleotides will be translated into a sequence of amino acids. And the taxi RNA does what? It hunts around the cell and it grabs an amino acid and it brings it to the ribosome so it can be incorporated into the protein. So those are the three kinds, and in short answer, what they do. Universal genetic code. We didn't talk about it. So I'm going to cross off number 11. All right. I didn't talk about number 12, but I'll mention it shortly. We've got a short answer. What the heck is a gene? Well, for instance, what is this right here? That's DNA, right? It's double-stranded. Got thymines in there and all that kind of stuff. Well, this is what's used to make a protein. And this DNA could be very long. How, if we take all the DNA inside your cell and stretch it from end to end, you know what? I think you might have about 250,000 miles. That would be like from here to the moon. I'll have to look that up. I might not have that exactly right, but I think I'm right. That's a really long stretch, but it's such a thin, small molecule, and it's all wound up. Okay, so there is some segment of that DNA, if you took all your chromosomes and lined it up end to end. But there's some sequence of DNA based on the sequence of nucleotides in DNA will make one protein. And that's what we call a gene. So a gene is just a segment in DNA that can be used to make a protein. And you have various proteins in your body, which means what? You need various genes on your chromosomes to make those different proteins. So a gene is the instructions on how to make a protein. And you find that in what? Chromosomes. All right, so that's that study question right there. Who's got a question? All right, so look those over. I don't know when the next test is, but it's probably not next week. Huh? But it might be the week after. I'm not sure. So start to write these out. And you know what's a really good idea? And I don't know if I've mentioned this in class before. Write out the answers to your questions and use that to study for the test. But if you write out an answer to a question right here and you write out the wrong answer, guess what you're going to study? The wrong answer. So if you want to come see me during office hours and just check your answers with me, I'll let you know so that when you study what? The right answers. But maybe you should get together with another student or something, or maybe check the tape and make sure that you're studying the right answers for this. So just because you write it out doesn't necessarily guarantee that it's 100%. So please come by my office hours, and students kind of pick up on that sometime during the semester, and it really makes a big difference in their grade. Okay? Yeah, somebody had a question. I don't want to say your name in the recorder. Yeah, the office hours are in the syllabus, but it's right after class. And Mondays and Wednesdays, I think it's at 10:30 till noon. And what's my office number? What's my room number? It's like the number of days in a year. Sorta. Minus 100. Okay? But it's a round number. 100 is a round number. So it's 265. It's up there, room 265. So it's pretty easy to remember. All right, so I think that's something important. What else, though? Guess what? We don't have a test this week, but I'm sure we have a quiz. Okay, so we have a quiz on Thursday over this stuff, and that's from what? The student study guide. Not the questions that we just went over, but the student study guide. Okay, if you don't have a student study guide, there's one in the library that you can check out, and the answers are there. All right, so we're going to switch gears and start talking about tissues. Let's see, what chapter is that? Chapter 5, maybe? Yeah, I think that's chapter 5. Okay, tissues. Well, let's think about how your body is put back together again. If we take a bunch of subatomic particles, like protons and electrons, and we put them together, what do we get? We get the next higher level of organization, which is an atom, right? An atom. So I covered up the periodic table for a test that my other class just took. What were the students saying when they walked out? You can't say? Okay, well, I'll grade it. So all of these elements, right, you can remember, have a certain number of protons inside the nucleus determine what kind of element it is, right? And the electrons are in orbitals around the nucleus. And if we put a bunch of atoms together, what do we get? Yeah, we get a molecule. Like, give me your favorite molecule. H2O. H2O is pretty good. Okay, hydrogen is an atom. Give me your favorite molecule. It's got to be what? NaCl, salt. Yeah, salt's pretty good. My favorite molecule, I'll just say ATP. Okay. Huh? That was yours? Good choice. Okay, so you put atoms together, you get a molecule. So let's work this hierarchy. If we put a bunch of different molecules together, what do we get? We get an organelle. Okay, so if you put a bunch of different molecules together, we get an organelle. And an organelle is specialized to perform a certain kind of function inside the cell. Like what? A mitochondria makes ATP. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum makes lipids. And if we put a bunch of organelles together, what do we get? We get a cell. Okay, and a cell is a basic building block of what? This is true, it's a basic building block of a tissue, but it's also a basic building block of another important concept, and that is life, right? If something is made up of cells, then it's alive. All right, but if we put a bunch of similar cells together, and they all have a similar kind of shape, and they have a similar kind of function, if we put those all together, they all look the same, then we get this tissue right here. All right, so now you kind of see where we are in the big scheme of everything in the class. So tissue is a group of cells, more than one cell, all with similar structure. They're all going to look the same, similar function. That means they're all going to be doing about the same kind of thing. And also, not just the cells, but all the junk in between the cells, which we call material between the cells, the extracellular material. So a tissue, all of that is going to be similar. And if you have a different tissue, then something is going to be different about it. Maybe the cell structure is going to look different, or its function is going to be different. And the study of tissues we call histology. So we know a bunch of ologies already. We know what? Chemistry. We know anatomy. We know physiology. Oh, I didn't tell you this, but the study of cells by itself is called cytology. Right? So we know a bunch of ologies in here. You know, and it's really important to know how all these cells are organized into tissues, because most disease processes happen at the tissue level. So if your grandma ever gets sick or you get sick or whatever, you're going to be very interested in knowing as much as you can about tissues. All right. But here's a really good thing about tissues. Of all everything in your body, it's only made up of four different kinds of tissues. So that's basically pretty simple. So if you point to someplace in your body, I could tell you what kind of tissue it is. And here are the four different kinds. You've got epithelium, you've got connective tissue, muscle tissue, and nervous tissue. And then there's another little thing over here which we call a membrane, which is a combination of two different tissues, an epithelium and connective tissue. So these tissues are specialized to do different things. Like, tell me what muscle is specialized to do.
Movement.
Yeah, I like movement. Motility is real important. But muscle, what? It contracts. Nervous tissue is specialized. You don't have a nerve that contracts, except if you're watching like a science fiction movie and people's brains, you know, from Mars, they kind of squish around. But that's not really nervous tissue. That'd be muscle tissue. But nervous tissue does what? It conducts electrical impulses from one part of your body to another. And then an epithelium. An epithelium covers a surface of your body. Or it lines a cavity. We have various cavities in our body. It's lined with an epithelium. And an epithelium also can make a gland. It makes glands. I think I have a slide here, but I'll tell you. Lines a cavity or covers a surface. Like the surface of your body is covered by an epithelium, and that's part of your integument. That's called your epidermis, thank you. Epidermis. That's an epithelium. Okay? Or it lines a cavity, like your digestive tract. And it can also make some glands. Connective tissue just connects different parts of your body together. All right, so I'm going to show you some pictures and I'll describe some of these things in a little bit more detail. Epithelium covers surfaces of the body, like your skin. All right, covers surfaces, lines a cavity, like the gastrointestinal tract. The inside of a blood vessel, you could consider that a cavity. It has a lining. That's an epithelium. But since it's on the inside of a blood vessel, we don't call it an epithelium, we call it an endothelium. But basically, it's an epithelium. All right? It forms glands. So if there's ever a part of your body that is producing a product for secretion, that tissue has got to be an epithelium. All right, an epithelium has very little extracellular material. What does that mean? That means the cells are packed real close together. For an epithelium, your skin, the cells are right next to each other. You don't have big holes between the cells of your skin. Okay, they're really tightly packed together. So that means what? That an epithelium is mostly made out of cells because all the cells are really close together. It has a free surface. For instance, the free surface of your epidermis is what? Right on the surface of your body right there. That's the free edge or free surface. As opposed to the deep part of the epithelium is going to be attached to some deeper part of you, like maybe the dermis, for instance. Okay. The deep part of the epithelium has a basement membrane. Just like if you start to build a building, what do you put the building on? You don't just build it right on the ground. You lay down a foundation. So the basement membrane is like a foundation for the epithelium. I'll show you some pictures and it'll make a lot of sense. Now here is something that's really strange, and it's characteristic of all epithelium. It never contains blood vessels. It's avascular. Avascular and never containing a blood vessel is exactly the same kind of thing. Even an alveolar kind of gland never has a blood vessel going through it. But a blood vessel might be close by, okay? But it will never go through it. And you know what? You probably realize that because your skin is an epithelium. Have you ever cut yourself and you've noticed it because you go, oh, with a paper cut or something, you go, ooh. And then you look and you go, oh, that was bad. And you look and you're not even bleeding for all that pain. Yeah. Right? And you go, huh, that's interesting. Why is that? Because an epithelium doesn't have a blood vessel. And you only did a really shallow cut into your epidermis and you didn't cut into a deeper layer that has blood vessels. So you kind of have a sense of that already. Right? So that's strange. All right. We talk about an epithelium in two major ways. We talk about it in terms of shape and how many layers it has. So for instance, by the shape of the cells. A squamous cell is flat. So this is just a flat. Give me a food that's flat. Pancake. Yeah. A squamous cell looks like a pancake to me. I suppose you could say a cracker, but pancake is more right in my mind. All right, so it's flat. That's an important shape for diffusion, okay, in the lungs and also in capillaries, because in order for diffusion to take place, you want it to go through something that's very thin. As opposed to a big, thick cell, then it'd be hard to get through the cell. But if it's a thin cell, then it's easy to go across it. All right, cuboidal. Guess what that means? Looks like a cube, like that. Okay? Kind of. So if you see a cuboidal cell, it's not a perfect cube, it's kind of a cube, just like my drawing. All right? Columnar. What is it? Well, it's going to be taller than a cube, but still kind of like a cube. So it's going to look something like this, right? Kind of like a cube, like a column. Cells aren't just perfectly shaped. So if you look at an epithelium, you can tell if it's flat, cuboidal, or columnar. Right, so that's by the shape. We also talk about epithelium by the number of layers that it has. And if it just has one layer, we call that simple. So simple is one layer. But if it's more than one layer, then we call it stratified. So if something exists in many layers, an epithelium, we call that a stratified epithelium. The next kind is kind of strange because sometimes maybe it looks cuboidal, sometimes it kind of looks flat, sometimes it looks columnar, sometimes it looks like a simple epithelium, sometimes stratified. We call that transitional. And I'll show you a picture how it's a little bit of both, but more importantly, it can change shape. So whenever you have an organ that can change shape drastically, then it will have a transitional epithelium. And a good example there would be urinary bladder. Because, for instance, maybe you've been out drinking all night and you go to bed. Okay? What's going to happen? Your kidneys are going to be producing urine all night long when you're sleeping. Your bladder does what? Gets bigger, 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 stretches out. The lining of the bladder is an epithelium. That's a transitional epithelium, so it stretches out. Okay? As the bladder gets bigger. And then when you get up in the morning and void, what happens to your urinary bladder? It goes back to its original shape, and the transitional epithelium then goes back to really flat, long cells to more cuboidal, pillow-shaped, or columnar-type cells. So it actually shifts its shape depending on the state of how big that particular organ is. So that would be an example. Okay, so let's look at some pictures. Pictures might be more interesting to look at. So here are some pictures with micrographs on one side and illustrations on the other. And as you train your eye, it's easier to see the illustration first, which is what? Kind of a perfect rendition of what you see underneath a microscope. Well, what do you got? Here is an epithelium. And in terms of layers, right, here is some deep tissue here. This is the free edge, the surface of the tissue. How many layers, as you go from here to here, make up this epithelium? Is it one or two or many or what? As you go from here to here. It's just one, right? I just see one cell right here. There's a nucleus and a nucleolus inside that cell. So would we call it stratified or simple? That's simple. So here's an example of a simple cell. And does it look cuboidal? No. This is actually a nice thin cell. It's a flat cell. So we would call that a squamous. As a matter of fact, we would combine both of those terms to completely characterize that particular epithelium, namely what? A simple squamous epithelium. And then you see this dark line right here? That's the foundation of this epithelium. We don't call it a foundation, but it actually sounds real good. Maybe I made up a new word right here. Okay, but we do call it the basement membrane. Okay, the basement membrane, which helps attach the epithelium to these deeper structures right here, which we call connective tissue. All right, so simple squamous, one layer, flat cells. Instead of looking on edge, we could look down on the top of these cells, and that's what these look like right here. right? And they kind of look like what? Looking down on top of a bunch of pancakes, right? So these are, this is a squamous cell. You can't tell number of layers, but this is just the previous slide from a different view, so it would be a simple squamous epithelium. All right, what else do you see right here that we could mention? What about the space between these cells? There's no space, almost non-existent. Epithelium, the cells are right together. What about blood vessels? You see any blood vessels there? No blood vessels. Again, nice characteristic of epithelium. Okay. Now, here's another kind of epithelium. Let me turn around just correct right here. This kind of epithelium is making a tube that's going in and out of the plane of the picture. Okay. And so it's making a tube, and here I see the epithelium. Here I see the basement membrane right here. And I see the interior part of the tube right there. Right? Whenever you have a tube, like your digestive tract or even a blood vessel, the hollow interior part of the tube is what we call a lumen. You see that on here? Lumen is pointing to what? The interior hollow part of this particular tube. So if this was a straw going like this, right, and we cut it and look down on the top, that's what you're looking at right there. And the end part of the straw would be what? The lumen. Okay. All right, well, what do these cells look like? Okay, do they look like columns? Okay, to my eye, they're cuboidal. They look kind of like cubes. Right? And indeed, they're cubes. And how many layers? Just one. So we call that a simple cuboidal epithelium. Basement membrane and lumen right there. All right, let's use our terminology some more. Let's look at this slide right here. All right, now what do these cells look like? Do they look like cubes? No, that should really look columnar to you. All right, and as you go from right here, this is the lumen, for instance, of maybe your digestive tract. Okay. When you go from the free edge right here down to the basement membrane, how many cells do you see from here down to here? Just one. So is that stratified or simple? That's simple. So this would be a simple columnar epithelium. You see some other things happening in here which are a little interesting, kind of a little strange. This cell right here that has this big, I don't know, glob of stuff in it. A goblet cell is a columnar cell that is secreting mucus into the lumen of the duct right here. So a goblet is a secretory cell that's secreting mucus. So what good is moco? Okay, it's slippery, so it's a good lubricant. It's a protein, so it acts like a buffer. It helps adjust pH. It can also trap dust particles. So you have mucus in your trachea, your windpipe. So when you inhale, dust gets trapped in that mucus, and the cells have cilia on them. And guess which way the cilia are beating? They're beating up so that the dust particles that you inhale get expelled from your lungs instead of being trapped deep down in the interior recesses of your lungs. So mucus does a number of things. Okay, it can trap dust particles, can act as a lubricant, can act as a buffer, and your stomach secretes mucus because it helps protect the lining of the stomach, right, this columnar epithelium from being digested, because mucus is very hard to digest. And mucus also kind of runs out of your nose when you have a cold. Okay, and that's kind of a good thing because there are digestive enzymes in the stuff that's coming out of your nose that help digest bacteria or viruses that are infecting you. And those little digestive enzymes probably is the reason why you might get like really chapped or something when you have a really runny nose. Okay, so simple columnar epithelium right here. What do we got here? Okay, here we see some cells that kind of look columnar here and here. You see, once you know this stuff, it's what? It's fun. It's actually fun to be able to look at these pictures and know what's going on. Okay? All right, so here you have a columnar cell. And here is a little cuboidal cell right here. So guess what we call this? This is pseudostratified, because sometimes you have one cell that goes all the way from the free edge down to the basement membrane. Sometimes it's stratified. You can't always tell. So this is what we call pseudostratified. And here are these cilia that are sweeping. Here's that goblet cell again that's secreting mucus. All right, so this would be a pretty nice representation of the kind of epithelium that you have lining your trachea or windpipe. Okay? All right. Let's see, what do we got here? Where's that basement membrane at? Right here, see the basement membrane? Okay, whenever you look at, in the future, maybe you're going to take an anatomy class or something, that's one of the first things that your eye should be attracted to, is this basement membrane right here. Because immediately then you're going to see a difference between this tissue here and this tissue here. And then when you see this tissue here, you're going to say what? Oh, this is simple or stratified. Stratified, right? Many layers of cells. But maybe you're actually working for a living, looking at tissues. Again, you're really interested in this basement membrane because it should be what? Nice and straight and uniform. If all of a sudden you're following a basement membrane and you see this big nasty bulge like that sticking out of it, that's bad. Because that means that's probably some kind of cancer that's forming, right? So you always want to find nice lines of demarcation between various kinds of tissues. So the basement membrane is just something that you should just automatically pick up. What about the shape of these cells right here? Can you tell me what those look like? Columnar, cuboidal, or squamous? Squamous. So this epithelium we call what? Stratified squamous epithelium. We use that terminology. But you probably notice and say, hey, wait a second. These cells don't look squamous here, but these look squamous up over here. And this is true. For a stratified squamous epithelium, these are more cuboidal down by the basement membrane. But you know what? They migrate. They start to migrate up to the surface. And as they migrate, they change their shape and become very flat. And so we name this epithelium after the cells that are in this layer up over here as opposed to the deeper layer, stratified squamous epithelium. Okay, another couple pictures. Who put these slides together upside down and backwards? Okay, what do these cells kind of look like? Flat or cube? Yeah, cube. So here's cuboidal, but is this simple or stratified? Stratified. So this is a stratified cuboidal epithelium. And what is this inside of the tube called? That's the lumen. And here we can see the basement membrane. It's awfully loopy right here. It's not so loopy right here. It really should be more of a nice straight edge. Okay, so stratified cuboidal. And then what the heck is this? Okay. These cells right here, I wish I could zoom in. What does that cell kind of look like? A cube or a column? All right, and then we see what? Another columnar cell underneath it. So we would not want to say simple. We would want to say stratified columnar epithelium. What could that be from? Stratified, I'm going to have to think a second. Your reader connection, stratified cuboidal. I don't know. I'll think about it. Okay, here's what a transitional epithelium looks like. These cells right here really don't look squamous. They don't look nice and cuboidal. They don't look columnar. But these are the kinds of cells. Let's see, do I have it? Yeah. Okay. So these cells right now are not stretched out. But as a bladder fills up, these cells are going to stretch out in the right to left direction, like over this. And you see what? They look kind of squamous right here. So the bladder now would be full. And then after voiding, what would happen to this epithelium? It would go back to that shape right there. So the cells are stretched out. Here they're kind of puffed up. A transitional epithelium. So a transitional also has the connotation of being what? Simple or stratified? It's stratified. It's a stratified epithelium. Okay, so that's all epithelium. One last thing. Epithelium lines a cavity or covers a surface. What else does it do? Right? It makes glands for secretion. So all epithelium or all glands are made out of epithelium. So that's something else that I want you to know. Epithelium. So glands, it could be a single cell, or it could be multicellular. Give me the name of a gland that's just a single cell. I showed you one already. The name of a cell that's just one, just a single cell, and it secretes something, and it's that goblet cell. And what's the chemical that it secretes? Yeah, mucin, or you could say mucus, right? Mucus or mucin. Either onto a surface or into a cavity. Other glands secrete something directly into the blood. You don't want to be secreting mucus into the blood necessarily, but there might be other compounds you want to secrete into the blood, and those would be something that we call a hormone. Give me a name of a hormone. Testosterone. Estrogen. Okay. They're secreted by some kind of epithelial-based tissue. And that secretion then gets picked up by the blood and it's carried everywhere in your body. That would be called a hormone. Okay. So glands can be classified as to one of two different kinds. The most general kinds of differentiation. An exocrine gland versus an endocrine gland. And an exocrine gland is a gland that has ducts associated with it. So these cells, it's a group of epithelial cells that are producing some kind of product. And that product gets secreted into a tube, and the tube carries it to where it should be going in the body. That's an exocrine gland. A good example of that would be when your pancreas makes digestive enzymes. Should those digestive enzymes be let loose in the pancreas? What would happen to your pancreas if all of a sudden it got surrounded by digestive enzymes? It would get digested away. Well, that'd feel real bad, right? So those digestive enzymes are not just let go in the pancreas, they're secreted into a tube which carries it to what? Your digestive tract, where they enter into your small intestine and then they digest away the food that you eat. Right? That would be a really good example of an exocrine gland. As opposed to endocrine gland. Endocrine gland doesn't have any ducts. It secretes its product, not into a duct, but just outside the cell, and it's picked up by the blood. And then where does it go? It goes everywhere that blood goes. It goes all over your body. So a hormone can't control all the various distant places of your body because blood is going there. So if you have an endocrine gland, it makes a hormone, secretes it, it's picked up in the blood, and it goes everywhere. It goes to your brain, goes to your stomach, goes to your leg muscles, all over the place. So remember, an endocrine gland is ductless, has no ducts. An exocrine gland has ducts, and it carries the product specifically to a certain kind of location. Okay, the types of exocrine glands I'm not going to talk about, so you're not going to be responsible for those. But you can take a look in your book. It's not a very complicated designation, but I'm not going to test you on that. Okay, the next kind of tissue, well, I find the sign-in sheet, is what we call connective tissue. All right, so connective tissue holds cells and tissues together. And connective tissue is inherently different than an epithelium. Remember, in an epithelium, we said that there's hardly any extracellular space. It's mostly cells that are all packed together. There's a sign-in sheet. Yeah, so sign it and pass it around real quick. Okay, now that's a lot different than a connective tissue. A connective tissue has big spaces between cells. So So as a matter of fact, the most important thing about a connective tissue is not necessarily the cells themselves, but it's the space between the cells. And it's so important that we give it a special name. We call it the matrix. So a connective tissue has an extensive extracellular space, or you could say an extensive matrix. All right, the first kind of connective tissue, but connective tissue does have blood vessels in it, or some kinds of connective tissue do. Dense connective tissue. You know what? I don't want to start with that one. I want to start with loose connective tissue. Loose connective tissue is found between muscles and between glands. It kind of just holds these things together. There's a chemical called collagen, and that's dissolved in the matrix, the stuff that's in between cells. And the collagen molecules are long fibers, and they can take any kind of orientation. So it can form a network even. So if we look at loose connective tissue, this is what it looks like. Right here. And actually, if you just look at the real micrograph right here, when I look at loose connective tissue, it's always easy for me to pick it out because it reminds me of something. What does that remind you of? Do you see different colors in there? Yeah? You can maybe, sometimes there's a fat cell in there that's kind of yellow. Sometimes you might see a blood vessel going by and it looks kind of red. These kind of look gray or blue, but don't forget I'm colorblind, so you know maybe I don't have any idea what I'm talking about. Does that look blue right there? No, huh? Where? Okay, well, but here's a dark fiber, here's a lighter fiber, but it's a lot thicker. But nonetheless, all these fibers are what? They form all these angles. So when I see loose connective tissue, I see a stained glass window. Okay, does it kind of remind you of a stained glass window? No? Okay. Okay, art is in the eye of the beholder. All right, so I see a stained glass window. So I see collagen fibers here. I see some elastic fibers right over here. And there's a difference between those two different kinds of fibers, but nonetheless, they're always secreted by this cell. This is a fibroblast. And guess what? Here's another fibroblast. Look at the big space between them. What is that space called again? That's called a matrix. All right, so these cells are secreting collagen and elastic fibers into the matrix. Now, you probably know something about elastic fibers in that you can stretch them, and when you let go, what's going to happen to them? They go back to where they should be, as long as you don't like really pull it too hard. So elastic fibers are not real strong. There's a lot of give to them, but after the tension is released, that tissue goes back to the way that it should be. Collagen, on the other hand, is not like that. It doesn't stretch. You could think of this fiber right here as being a steel cable. Can you stretch a steel cable? No. But if you do, you damage it, right? So collagen can resist tension from this direction to this direction, just a tremendous amount of force. So you could think of collagen maybe even as a Kevlar fiber. Kevlar you can't stretch either. It just doesn't stretch. So collagen gives this tissue a lot of strength. It just won't pull apart. It won't separate, right? Okay. Also in loose connective tissue or areolar connective tissue, we have this fluid part right here, which is what we call the ground substance. So the matrix can have fibers and it can have ground substance. The collagen resists stretching. These elastic fibers are in there so that if it does stretch a little bit, it will go back to its original position. Two different kinds of fibers, but nonetheless, collagen and elastic fibers are made by what kind of cell? What kind of cell secrete? That fibroblast right there. The fibroblast makes collagen. Okay. All right, we always think of building blocks. It's always nice to know. And the building block of collagen, does anybody know what the building block of collagen is? It's kind of like an amino acid. It's actually ascorbic acid. And does anybody know what ascorbic acid is? Okay, not LSD. It's lysergic acid. Oh, you didn't say that. Oh, okay. Okay, ascorbic acid is vitamin C. Vitamin C. Okay, so vitamin C is used to make these collagen fibers right here. Citric acid. Ah, okay, not quite citric acid. All right, so whenever you see this stained glass window, think of loose connective tissue. All right. Now let's go to dense connective tissue. Here's dense connective tissue. Here's a cell here, and here, and here, and here, and here, with a big space between them. Right, so you know this is not an epithelium. All of these fibers right next to each other, they're all parallel. These are collagen fibers. All right, so a collagen fiber, you can pull on it from end to end, and this thing is not going to stretch, and it's almost impossible to damage. So this kind of connective tissue might connect a muscle to a bone, which is a tendon. Or it might connect a bone to a bone, in which case we call it a ligament. And it's very strong, as long as you what? You pull from here to here. But what happens if you pull from here to here? Guess what can happen? Okay, then you can actually tear apart because you can cause a little hole right in there. Just like if you take a string or something and you pull from end to end, it's pretty tight. But if you pull from edge to edge, you can separate a string very easily because of the orientation of the fibers. The same things for tendon and ligaments. The way you damage them is by using them inappropriately in a way a joint hasn't been designed. Right? And then fluid will build up in that little tear, and it will be real easy to see on an MRI or something because it will look a lot different than the tendon. So this is dense connective tissue made of collagen. And who's ever sprained an ankle in here? Yeah, a lot of people. Or some other kind of joint. And so that means you've used that joint in a way that it hasn't been designed, and guess what happens? You pull on tendons and ligaments in this direction instead of the longitudinal one, and you cause these little rips. Now, what do you need to repair that tendon? What's that building block? And when if you ever sprained an ankle or something and you went to see a doctor, did they ever tell you you should take a lot of what? A lot of vitamin C, the building block, to help repair that tendon. Okay, see, you might know more than some of your physicians out there now. Because of what? Building block. Right? You've never been told that. That's a shame. Okay? And your body can't store vitamin C, and you should have vitamin C every day in your diet anyway. But if you're trying to repair a tendon or ligament, then you should probably have even a little bit more. All right? Okay. Now, there is something about this tendon and ligament that is also obvious to me, and that is, do you see any blood vessels in here? No. So this is true. So here's a kind of connective tissue that doesn't have a lot of vascularity so that when you damage a tendon, guess what? It takes a long time to heal because it doesn't have a blood supply to bring in nutrients and to bring in oxygen and also to wash out other kinds of debris. So tendinous injuries sometimes take a long time to heal from because of that reason. All right. Here's something, another kind of connective tissue. This is cartilage. And cartilage does not look like a stained glass window to me. It's just kind of a little speckle pattern. I just see all these cells just kind of speckled around all over the place. And the cells that make up cartilage are not called fibroblasts. They're called chondrocytes. So anytime you hear chondro, you should think of cartilage. All right? And so these are little cartilage cells. They live in a special little bubble inside the cartilage. So here's the matrix of cartilage. This is the ground substance of cartilage. And this little bubble that holds, here's a bubble that has two cells in it. It's called a lacunae, or a little lagoon. So chondrocytes you find inside lacunae, inside cartilage. And again, do you see any blood vessels in cartilage? Nope, I don't see any blood vessels. So again, that should tell you what? When you damage cartilage, it may never heal because there just aren't any blood vessels, or if it does, it will take a very, very long time. Okay, so you have chondrocytes inside those lacunae. We can make cartilage a little bit more complicated for our purposes. All right, again, I kind of see that little speckle pattern. I see chondrocytes inside that little bubble, which we call a lacunae. But now I see some fibers in the matrix as well. So this would be a good example of elastic cartilage. Okay, demonstrate some elastic cartilage for me. Like in your ear, right? You can deform that cartilage and it will go back to its original location as long as you don't hammer it too hard and damage these elastic fibers. In which case you would get what? A cauliflower ear. I don't know if I've ever seen one in person, but you know, it certainly does happen. Yeah, like people that box and get hit in the ear all the time. All right, so again, you have chondrocytes inside those lacunae. And furthermore, you have another kind of cartilage that's even stronger. And we call that fibrocartilage. Here you can see lacunae with chondrocytes in there, but now you can see these nice long linear chains of collagen. And a good place where you might find fibrocartilage is an intervertebral disc, a disc between the vertebrae in your back. So this is the strongest kind of cartilage. It doesn't move very much, but it cushions a lot of shock, so it can absorb a lot of shock. Oh, I didn't say something about this kind of cartilage. So there is fibrous, elastic, and this kind of cartilage right here is what we call hyaline cartilage. It doesn't have any fibers in it. This is real important because it helps form joints. This is what prevents friction from developing when two joints are right next to each other and they move. All right, so this is a nice slippery surface. This allows bones to move past each other without grinding each other down. Hyaline cartilage. Okay. Well, we're almost done with connective tissue, but I think I'm done talking for today. I'm just going to throw this one last slide up because it's so easy to recognize. Okay. That kind of looks like we're in a botany class right now, but it's not, right? Because if you see that, what would you see? Like tree rings, right? The lamellae of a tree ring. Well, this kind of connective tissue is bone connective tissue with these concentric lamellae around it. And we're going to begin next time when we start talking about bone connective tissue. Start here. Oh, what about the quiz for today? Oh, there's no quiz. It's Tuesday. Thursday. Okay, Thursday. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see, module 5, what module is this that we were talking about today? That's 5. Okay, if you need module 4, I have it in my office. Okay. Yeah, that's it. Okay, so that's it for today.